Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCellaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, November 1st, 2015, and this is show number 547. I think I should mention the beginning of the show for a while till everybody catches up that I have recently split the NoCellaCast into two shows. The traditional part I do alone, which is what you're going to hear now, and the interview part, Chit Chat Across the Pond, is now in its own standalone show. This means it will be way easier to point people directly to one interview, and will help if you ever want to go back and maybe listen to something again. For example, Kevin this week asked me if I could point him to the episode where Pat Dingler talked about becoming a member of the Apple Certified Network. I had to hunt through all kinds of other information to find it, but if it had been one of the new standalone episodes, that would have been much easier for him. If you want to hear both shows, you need to search for Chit Chat Across the Pond in your favorite podcatcher and subscribe to that too, because you will not get it automatically. And I don't want you to miss it. I hope everybody will go subscribe. Maybe even more people than are going to listen to me blather. Who knows? Well, I am still cleaning up some bits and bobs, as Bart would say, like figuring out what to do with the NoCellaCast news. The NoCellaCast News gives you a newsletter whenever the NoCellaCast comes out, including the show description and relevant links. People evidently really like it. I get metrics on how often people open it, and way more than the industry average for newsletters do, so apparently people like it. I think one of the things they really like is there's a really easy way to unsubscribe if you don't like it. More people are growing, and you know more people are subscribing over time, but I do see people unsubscribe, and it's like, that's cool. If you're not getting value out of it, why be bothered? So that's very cool. But now, that's called the NoCellaCast News. What do I do about Chit Chat Across the Pond? Well, I asked your collective advice in the Google Plus community, podfeet.com/Google Plus, and we decided to make the newsletter come out whenever there's a Chit Chat Across the Pond or a NoCellaCast. So you get both notifications in one newsletter. Well, actually, there'll be two newsletters if I do two a week. We decided that we liked the alliteration of NoCellaCast News, but we needed to incorporate Podfeet instead. Now, while Alistair wanted us to call it Princess Podfeet's Pontifications, we decided to go with the milder form and just call it the Podfeet Press. The good news is that once I get all this set up and working, it works really well. I use a tool called MailChimp, which for some reason is free, so you can do this too if you want to bother people. Anyway, I create a template for what it's supposed to look like and a list of people to receive it, and every night at 9 p.m. it checks to see if I've released a podcast. If I have, it generates the newsletter for you. So the way it does that is it takes the RSS feed that drives the podcatchers, it can go check that. That's pretty slick. And inside MailChimp, I found a tool that said showed you could combine two feeds into one. So I was able to create a third feed that gives us both. And so I was able to tell the newsletter to go out when that feed goes, which has both of them in it. So that's kind of cool. The only problem is I have a lot of trouble understanding how to mess around in these templates of what it looks like. So you remember it took me weeks to get the text play nicely with the mobile view a few weeks ago? Well, now I had to come up with a new logo, which is the two logos side by side. Really, really tricky. But I had to do some, I haven't figured out how to edit the template once it's inside of one of these campaigns, they call them. And so I think I did it right for the combination of the two shows. But I think there's a really good chance you're going to get an email after the show goes live that just has a bunch of gibberish code in the mail. I'm hoping it fills it all in correctly, but I'm not sure it's going to do it right. And I'm betting someone out there will tell me if that happens. Fingers crossed, because I can't actually tell for sure until it goes out. By the way, you'll still get notifications of any kind of big news through the Podfeet Press, like my web server being down, canceling the live show, as well as of the notifications of when the two shows come out. So I hope that makes everybody happy. I spoke a bit on the show about the Creative Kit 2016 MacFun extensions for Photos and how much I liked them. If you want to learn more in depth about them, I did a really good, I'm really proud of this, a really good screencast for Don McAllister's Screencast Online that he published this week. In it, I did a deep dive into my favorite of the suite, and it's called Intensify CK. And then in a couple of weeks, I'm going to go through the rest of them for an additional show. They're all going to be packed into one show because the interface is pretty easy between those to show you. You can see the trailer for the Intensify CK video at a link I put in the show notes. It's Screencast Online episode 527. You can watch the entire show if you're already a member of Screencast Online, or if not, you can get a free 14-day trial for Screencast Online or at screencastonline.com. Well, Steve and I bought the first generation Apple TV, And we disliked it so much, we sold it to Jonathan Koss for, I think it was $50, just to get it out of our house. We bought Gen 2 and Gen 3, and we liked those quite a bit better. Our use case is split between using it for AirPlay, video podcasts thrown to the TV from an iPad, and then to rent movies on iTunes. Those are pretty much the two main things we do. There's a little bit of Netflix here and there, but we tend to reach for the Roku for Netflix a little more often than we do for the Apple TV. We do also use it to watch the Apple keynotes, but, you know, that's only a couple of times a year. We definitely do not need another Apple TV, but we were also definitely swayed by the cool new remote. Even if the old Apple TV remote wasn't the worst piece of doo-doo Apple had ever invented, the new remote has some wicked cool features like Siri search that were just too compelling to ignore. The interface of the new 4th-gen Apple TV looked really pretty. Not functionally that much different, but it looked really pretty, and the possibility of cool new apps sounded swell. Well, Steve pre-ordered the Apple TV and chose the 32GB version over the 64GB version, mostly because from what we've heard, the storage is mostly required for game data, and we're not into gaming. We also figured if it was too small, that would give us an excuse to replace another older Apple TV with a new one, right? You really got to think ahead and come up with your excuses for the flowdown. Well, the ordering process really irritated Steve. Most Apple products have come with free shipping, but he had to choose between standard shipping and an expedited shipping of $17. Now, that would have maybe made sense, but there was a significant overlap between the dates of shipping, and neither regular nor expedited shipping was going to get it to him on release day, October 30th, or at least wasn't going to guarantee him that he was going to get it on Friday the 30th of October. So he went ahead and went for slow boat shipping. But then Apple got him really salty when they announced on the 29th that the Apple TV would be available in stores on Friday. He isn't the kind of person to get all up in arms about stuff. That's usually my job. But he was so mad he actually wrote to Tim Cook, suggesting it was really mean of him not to tell us that it would be available in stores on release day. Like, why get the people mad? Like, you could pay $17 for expedited shipping and you're going to get it after the person who just strolls into the store? That didn't make any sense. Well, anyway, of course, we bought one on release day, too. We put all that shipping angst behind us, and we decided to just walk into the store and buy one. And then we sold Dorothy, the one that we bought online. So it's all good. We got one. She got one. Everybody's happy. Anyway, let's talk about the fun of the new Apple TV. In the box, you get the new remote, a lightning cable to charge the remote. Now, that's a nice touch and a $17 value. You get the Apple TV itself and a power cable. And, of course, a couple of those little Apple stickers, the little ones. The new Apple TV is about a third thicker than the older models, but the same footprint. We swapped out our 3rd gen for the new 4th gen and fired it up. And the initial setup was really cool. Since this device will be talking to your iCloud account, you're offered the option of using an iOS device to hand off the appropriate settings to the Apple TV, including Wi-Fi settings. All you have to do is make sure your iOS device is unlocked with Bluetooth on, and you kind of just put it near the Apple TV, and the Apple TV is configured automatically. It was really, really sweet. I was so happy to not have to type in my long, complex password I got from Bart's XKPassWD tool. I love that password. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love his tool, but man, I hate to type that on those little tiny remotes. Well, it worked perfectly. I got a notification on the phone asking me if I wanted to configure the Apple TV. I hit yes, and it was done. Next, the Apple TV wanted to know if we wanted location services turned on. We couldn't think of a reason why we'd want to do that, so we declined, but I noted one really good thing. Neither option was the default. That means that you have to actively choose to enable location services. Yes or no, you had to choose. I thought that was a good move on Apple's part. Next was time zone selection, which was my first opportunity to use the touchpad on the Apple TV. While it is not as heinous as using the old remote, typing in the name of my city was really irritating. On the old Apple TV interface, the letters were in a grid, and now they put them all in a nice, really long line, nice horizontal line. Think about if I have to type, say, Sheridan. S is all the way down on the right. A is all the way down on the left. S, H, E, R. Think about going back, forth, back, forth. Really, really mean of them to do this. It was pretty and made nice little popping graphics while I was going back, forth, back, forth, back, forth to entertain me, but it was very tedious. Next up, it asked me if we wanted to use Siri. Again, Apple did not default this to use or don't use Siri. You have to be an active participant whether you want Siri to listen to you. Now, I also want to mention that the Apple TV remote has a dedicated Siri button, so it is not listening to you at all times. You have to press and hold the button down for Siri to be able to hear you. I'm just barely getting the hang of holding it down. I have a habit of hitting it and then letting go, but you have to press and hold it, so she is not listening to you when you're not holding that button down. Now, just to entertain you, the Apple TV asks you if you want to automatically download the Aerial Screensaver. It's HD video from beautiful locations around the world. It tells you this is going to be around 600 megabytes worth of download a month, and you can change it at any time. Again, you have to actively choose to download or not. We have to justify our next bigger Apple TV, so we said yes. Finally, it asked if we want to share app analytics with developers. I actively chose to share. Again, you have to choose it. And then I had to agree to the warranty page showing 1 year. I really hate looking at that because it makes me sad knowing that everybody in Europe is guaranteed 2 years of warranty by law. Oh well. Finally, the Apple TV was configured and it was gorgeous. The very first thing I wanted to do was test Siri search. From what we'd been told, it could find things across all services that have hooked into their API, unlike the Amazon Fire that searches the Amazon services but does not search, say, inside Netflix. I did what any good no-silly castaway would do. I held down the dedicated Siri button and I said, "Show me Star Trek Next Generation." It found it immediately and then offered it to show it to me in iTunes, Netflix, and Hulu. I was free to choose any of them. I searched for Homeland, and that time it found it in iTunes and in Showtime. The search across services works perfectly. I should tell you that Dorothy has put a whole bunch of her movies inside her iTunes library, and it doesn't search that, which is really disappointing. She said that she heard Rene Ritchie and I Moore saying that they were going to extend the search to go inside your iTunes library, but she's not going to hold her breath on that. All right, now it's time to get me some apps, because I didn't have Showtime or Netflix yet on my Apple TV. I went to the app button and I chose Netflix. It had a little install button and I was in business. But then I went into the Netflix app and of course it made me log in. Now my son set up the account and he has a super long email address and a really nice long complex password with letters and numbers and punctuation just like I taught him. No worries, that's okay. I'm just going to open up my iPhone, launch 1Password, put down my fingerprint, copy the password. Then I figured I'd flip over to the remote app that sees all three of my older Apple TVs and just paste it in. Except it doesn't work with the new Apple TV yet. Okay, that was really annoying. Took me 2 tries and I think about 7 minutes later to get that password in, and then I was in business. In the App Store, some apps say install, like Netflix did, and you can simply push that button, but some say get. If you click on get instead of installing immediately, it makes you enter your gosh darn Apple ID credentials. The only thing worse than Kyle's new username and password is my Apple ID and password. Remember how excited I was about using XKPassWD and that long, complex password? Yeah, I might have cursed Bart under my breath a few times. And remember how cool it was that I was able to use my iPhone a few minutes ago to authenticate with that very same gosh darn Apple ID? Nope, it's not going to remember it. I've got to type it in. So I spent another 3 minutes typing in that password again, swearing under my breath at the developers of the remote app for not getting that thing ready for me. Also, Steve thought, why don't we just use a Bluetooth keyboard? Guess what? Can't use Bluetooth keyboards with the Apple TV 4. They just hate us. They really do. They took the letters, made them in a long string instead of a grid, won't let you use the remote app. You can't use 1Password. You can't use your Bluetooth keyboard. All right, I decided to test out home sharing. And guess what I have to type in? You got it. My Apple ID credentials. My new criteria for what I'll install is whatever doesn't make me type in my Apple ID credentials again, which is only apps that say install next to them. We did go and want to watch a movie and to rent a movie on Friday night. And when we went to do it, it wanted my Apple ID credentials again. Well, I was pretty irritated by that. But then the next thing it said was pretty interesting. It said, "You want me to just save this for you?" So we said, yes, we don't even care if it just put it out on the public internet. We were so tired of this. We're assuming it probably saved it in the local in the device, but we were so tired of it by that time. Now, I haven't gone back and checked to see whether I can download and install apps without having to type that in, but I'm pretty sure I don't have to do it for movies anymore. Well, I'm going to be keeping a close eye on storage for a while because we got the 32 gig version, but so far it looks like we're probably going to be fine. I installed 4 apps, and in settings, I took a look at managed storage. Netflix was 12 megabytes, Periscope was 5 megabytes, and both NBC and YouTube were both under a megabyte. Oddly, it did not show me that fancy pants aerial screensaver, the one with the HD video in the storage, over in that storage listing. That would have been nice. You know, they said it was on average 600 megabytes a month of downloads, but it didn't show you how much instantaneous storage it takes up. All right, let's get back to the remote because it's just as happy-making as I hoped it would be. Except for the password part. An unexpected pleasure was that I can control the audio volume with the Apple TV remote. We have our Apple TV plugged into a Dolby 7.1 stereo receiver via HDMI, and then the receiver sends one HDMI signal to the TV. So it's pretty cool that the Apple TV can now control the audio level on the receiver. Once we start a movie, we will only need one remote. Finally, one of my favorite things about Apple TV with Siri and the new remote is that at any time you can hold down the Siri button and say, "What did he say?" And the show backs up 15 seconds and plays back with subtitles turned on. Now, in case you think that Apple made fire here, it is wonderful, it is lovely, but our Roku does the same thing when you turn, it turns on subtitles when you back up 15 seconds, but you had to go in and configure it to do that. And plus, this is kind of cool to just go, "What did he say?" That's kind of fun. On the subject of subtitles, turning them on at all on the old Apple TV was a huge pain. If you were watching a movie, you had to completely back out of watching the movie, dive, I think it was 62 levels deep into settings, back out of that, and then try to get back to your movie and play, but it would have moved and you couldn't figure out where it was because you rented it and it was really hard. Now you simply say, "Turn subtitles on," when you press the Siri button. This makes me so happy. Bottom line, I love the new Apple TV, mostly because of the new remote with Siri, and the search works really, really well, and I have a feeling we're going to be buying more of these over time. Remember last week when I told you there were 3 of you left who hadn't yet bought Clarify? Well, there's only 1 of you left now, so this ad is for you, and that makes this the very last ad for Clarify. I've really loved advertising for the guys over at Blue Mango Learning. Greg and Trevor, the developers, have become friends, and they're great supporters of the show and have created a product you know I really love. I did a Google search to see how far back we go on podfeet.com, and I found the first time I ever heard of these guys and their products. It was February 24th, 2008, when research assistant Niraj told me about their product, ScreenSteps Desktop, which later morphed into Clarify. I should mention, by the way, that ScreenSteps is alive and well, and in fact, now that Clarify is working so well for consumers, they're putting the full court press on supporting their enterprise solutions with ScreenSteps. In all these years, I have never had a week when I didn't have a great story about how ScreenSteps or Clarify saved the day. Many of you have sent in your own testimonials on how it helped you look like a hero to your friends and family, or maybe helped you remember how to do something. On podfeet.com, I've posted a zillion tutorials, and I've got them over there. People continue to call me up write to me and say, "Hey, I just got this tutorial you wrote. Can you help me understand how to do this now?" In fact, 2 people this week did the same thing. I have a feeling that from time to time, I will still mention Clarify, and then you're going to know I really meant what I've said all this time, not just because they were advertisers. That's also when Greg and Trevor will figure out they probably could have stopped paying me a long time ago and I would have kept going. Unless something good comes along that I can endorse 100%, this will be an unsponsored show going forward. That means the Amazon affiliate link and the PayPal donation buttons over on podfeet.com will become the only source of income to support the show. As you head into the holiday shopping season, please consider using the Amazon link. All you have to do is click on the where it says Amazon, and then whatever you search for and buy at that point, whatever you buy in that session, a small percentage of that will come to help the show, and it won't cost you a nickel more. When Spellcheck first came out, it was a wonderful thing. We were so happy when we saw those nice squiggly lines showing us our typos. It was glorious. I'm a really good speller, as it turns out. In fact, I had my engineering degree questioned by one of my bosses, said, "What kind of an engineer can spell as well as you? Where did you go to school?" Anyway, I am a good speller, but I do make typos, so having that visual indicator was great. For some reason, I can spot typos a mile away in anyone else's writing. I mean, you can have a piece of paper upside down, backwards, upside down on the other side of the room, and I could see your typos, but my own are completely invisible to me. I've always thought it was a kind of arrogance gene I've got going on there that would think I can't possibly have made a mistake. Well, anyway, then came along autocorrect. At first, we heralded it as a revolution, a time saver, something about which we rejoiced. Then came the humorous autocorrect stories. We mocked it. We rejoiced in other people's failures, but we secretly grew to depend on it more and more. In spite of these great tools to find our mistakes and correct them, my blog posts are often riddled with errors. I've mentioned that I love it when people point them out because I simply cannot see them in my own writing unless I read them out loud, and I'm too lazy to do that ahead of time. Recently, I started using Telegram as my messaging app of choice, and oddly, the Mac app does not have autocorrect, while the iOS and web apps do. First, I thought that was a bad thing, but then I realized how freeing it was. I love to write things like, I'm so jealous with, you know, like 17 zeros, but autocorrect would always want to change that, and I would have to fight with it to get it back, sometimes 2-3 times to get it to take what I wanted. I like to write probably instead of probably. I don't know why. Just makes me happy. It's kind of silly. I also might want to write gonna instead of going to, but stupid autocorrect won't let me. Oh, I also like to write stupid with 2 O's instead of a single U. Hey, I'm having fun. I can type any way I want to, right? Not with autocorrect, I can't. But in Telegram, I was free to spell the way I wanted to spell. That gave me an idea. Why am I a slave to autocorrect? Why have I accepted this tyranny? I went hunting in System Preferences, Keyboard, Text, and I found a lovely checkbox that said, correct spelling automatically, and I unchecked it. Now, note, I did leave it to still let it check my spelling, so it will tell me I'm an idiot if I put too many O's in the word so, but it doesn't change it to what it thinks best. It'll still give me the little squiggly line. I've been running without autocorrect turned off on my Mac for more than a week now, and I love it. It's as wonderful as I hoped it would be. You know how I'm always saying that I love it if people tell me about typos in my blog posts? I really think you're going to see fewer mistakes from now because I'm in control. I think with autocorrect on, Apple was changing my typos to real words it thinks I meant to type, so I wasn't getting the squiggly lines that told me I'd made a mistake, so I couldn't see the mistakes. It's my theory anyway. It got put to the test this week with Steve checking my Apple TV post, and he found one typo. He usually finds a lot more, and in that case, I should have seen it. It was me just ignoring the squiggly line when I went back and looked at it. Armed with my new freedom, I raced to my iPhone and I turned off autocorrect there too. I thought, this is going to take a little bit of getting used to, so I left it off for about 3 days and I could not stand it. Back when Steve Jobs, in talking about how to type on iPhone, said, just trust it, many mocked him for that, and it took me a long time to actually get what he meant about trusting it. But if you do trust it, it really does remarkably well in typing if you just let it do its thing. Autocorrect off on iOS was a disaster. It was way too hard to type correctly. Even though I could tap and hold a word and choose a correction, I was just doing it all the time. I wasn't typing anything right. It took me about twice as long to type out a single sentence without autocorrect. I don't know if anybody else is like me in this, but I throw it out to you. Really think about whether autocorrect helps you or whether it just constrains your creativity. Don't be a slave to autocorrect. I was really excited when the new Apple Gear got announced this year. While I wasn't going to get an iPhone 6S because that was Steve's turn this year, I was still really looking forward to getting a new Apple TV and a new iPad Pro and its new keyboard and especially the Pencil. But the months went by and I didn't have any new toys to play with. I didn't even have my Apple TV yet. WatchOS 2 and iOS 9 and El Capitan were mildly entertaining for, like a day or two, but there was nothing really groundbreaking there either. I was bored. So when Apple announced the new Magic Keyboard Magic Trackpad 2, I thought, why not? You'll notice I haven't framed a problem to be solved other than boredom. So let's see if we can back into the justification, shall we? Many of us have moved away from wired input devices in favor of wireless keyboards, mice, and trackpads. We're far too ecologically minded to use disposable batteries, of course, so we've become masters at rechargeable batteries. We have a rotation schedule with multiple battery charges, we've got metrics on which batteries are best, and most of us have at least read, if not participated in, lengthy discussions online of our opinions on the subject of which batteries are best. Milliamp hours is a household word for us. Last year, I fell in love with the Mobi line of products that replaced the standard AA batteries in my Apple wireless keyboard and trackpad with what they called the Magic Bar. That allowed me to slide the bar and keyboard into a little charger on my desk whenever the battery got low. Worked great! But over time, I've become less enchanted with the Mobi line of products. They have really good engineering ideas, but they need to stop inventing new stuff and spend some more time on their quality control. The batteries don't last very long at all. I found I was charging every 1 to 2 weeks, and the micro USB cable slot wasn't very secure either, so I sort of like had to tape the cable in place, which was kind of dorky. So I had to give up on the Mobi. The next thing I thought about in trying to justify why I needed to spend this money is that over the last few months, I've come to really enjoy the short throw of the keys on the 12-inch MacBook keyboard. It took me a while, but I found myself now sitting in front of the MacBook Pro on my desk with the Apple Wireless, the old Apple Wireless keyboard, but I'd be leaning over to the left to type in the MacBook instead. The keys on the desktop keyboard started to feel grotesquely exaggerated to me because they move way too much. If that isn't a third world problem, I don't know what is. Now, I'm a huge fan of the Magic Trackpad, and I never thought I would be. We all used to immediately rush out and buy a mouse to use with our Mac laptops when we sat at our desk because trackpads are annoying. Of course, most of us didn't use the Apple mouses because they've traditionally been pretty awful. I'm not sure how I converted to intentionally using a trackpad instead of a mouse, but I can't stand using a mouse now. Using that scroll and scroll and scroll, it's like I feel like I'm getting carpal tunnel the minute I use them. Steve, on the other hand, is at the other end of the spectrum, but he's wrong and I'm right. Apple's trackpads are way better than any mouse. Justifying a new Magic Trackpad is a little harder than the keyboard, except for that pesky battery issue. I never thought the original model was too small or the color matched my MacBook Pro too well. Armed with this incontestable list of excuses, I bought the Magic Keyboard. I hate Bluetooth for how dodgy it is, but both of these devices paired instantly when I turned them on. I understand that if you don't even want to bother with the menus for pairing, you can simply plug them into your Mac via the lightning cable, but since I keep Bluetooth in my menu bar, it was easier to just use the pull-down menu. By the way, turning them on is now a very distinct little slider switch on the edge of each of the devices. Physical little switch that it's on the side away from you, so there's no more problem with wondering if that round button has been accidentally pressed or if your backpack got, you threw it in your backpack and they got turned on accidentally when you were toting them around. The first thing that surprised me was how big the Magic Trackpad 2 is. You may have heard that it's about 30% bigger than the old and busted Magic Trackpad 1, but that's actually misleading. The usable area is 30% bigger, but the total area it takes up on your desk is only 8% bigger. On the old one, the top 0.8 inches is part of the battery holder, and that's unusable space. The old one is pretty square. It's like around 5.1 by 4.5 inches, while the new one is kind of a landscape rectangle at 6.3 by 4.5. Like I said in my excuses to spend money section, I'm not sure I needed more space in my trackpad, but it doesn't hurt anything. It's also white instead of silver. No idea why they did that. The only thing I can think of is that Apple is in cahoots with the electronics cleaning products companies. It doesn't match my silver MacBook Pro or my space gray MacBook, but it does go well with the white keys on the keyboard, I suppose. The Magic Trackpad 2 comes with Force Touch, which might be a cool feature. Luckily, I watched Don McAllister's screencast online, so I learned a few of the things you can do with it in El Capitan. You can get a word definition, which is kind of cool. You can use it for quick look, because hitting the space bar with the hand that's already on the keyboard is such a chore. You can use it to rename files by pressing harder, because hitting enter with the hand still on the keyboard is such a chore. Well, I don't remember if it does anything else. That's all I can remember. What I do like about the new trackpad and the trackpad on the 12-inch MacBook is that it's not a real mechanical click. It's actually electronic with haptic feedback, but you would swear that it is clicking mechanically. If you don't believe me, go check one of these out and click it while turning off the switch on the back. The clicking will stop. It's totally freaky. It's a fun little party trick. Like I said earlier, the main reason to get the Magic Trackpad 2 is for ease of charging. I haven't had it long enough to test the battery life, but they promise a month before you're going to need to recharge, and that will be lovely. It's also lovely that it charges via the included lightning cable. Again, like the Apple TV, a $17 value right there. If you don't have a trackpad yet and you think you'd like one, I think the Magic Trackpad 2 is lovely, and its large glass screen and easy charging is way worth it. But if you don't have $129 burning a hole in your pocket and you already have a Trackpad 1, I wouldn't really lose sleep that you don't have it. Now for the Magic Keyboard. The Apple Wireless keyboard of yore, the non-extended one, also had about 0.8 inches of useless space at the top edge for the battery. And on the new keyboard, they simply chopped that off. Some have complained that it's harder to grab without mashing the keys, but I don't think it's that hard to pick up to me. The keyboard is significantly flatter than the original one, with the back end down about 30%. Time will have to tell on whether this is going to be ergonomically sound. I absolutely love the touch of the keys. They don't click, but they're not mushy. They feel just right to me, and I think my muscle memory between my MacBook and this keyboard are going to be very happy. I'm a touch typist, like I mentioned, and I pretty much have to be if I'm going to write as much as I do, and my typos are at a real minimum with this keyboard. So no autocorrect and a new keyboard, it's going to be perfect, right? Doomed. Anyway, at $89, the keyboard is about mid-range for a good keyboard, but remember, it comes with that $17 value Apple Lightning cable. If you think about what you're spending on chargers and rechargeable batteries, though, I think the Magic Keyboard with its one-month battery charge will actually start to save money over time and will definitely be more convenient immediately. Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsor for helping to pay the bills. For the very last time, the makers of Clarify over at clarify-it.com. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. You can argue with me on Twitter over at Podfeet, and go check out that NoSilicast Google Plus community too. We just keep having a ball in there, and that's where I ask a lot of questions when I get stuck, and there's great people in there who help me. Having a lot of fun over there. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, like Sybil did for the first time this week, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic NoSilicastaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.